G'day. Welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I'm going to be really quick on this intro because I'm doing two episodes in the one day. Wasn't meant to be. This was meant to come out 2 weeks later, but I sat down with Ryan Griffin, who is today's guest on the podcast, the creator of Clever Man, a brilliant show on the ABC that's been played all over the world and I absolutely fucking adored. And it is on ABC iView, which is the free catch-up service the ABC runs, for another week. So I just thought I'd put this up now. No point putting it up in 2 weeks when he tells you there's 1 week to go where you can watch it for free. And it was a week ago. So I'm going to put it up today because I want everyone to watch this show and it's for free. So get on the internet, get onto ABC iView. In fact, you know what? If you just downloaded this podcast and you haven't watched Clever Man yet, you can actually just pause this podcast and listen to it in 2 weeks. But what I just need you to know is this bit, this vital bit right now. Go to ABC iView and watch Clever Man. You have 1 week to watch 6 episodes. Watch one a day. Watch them all in a row. Take a day off work tomorrow and watch this show. Support this show. Share it around. It is a brilliant show and I can't wait for season 2. And this was a wonderful chat with Ryan Griffin, the creator, that we had tonight at the Chippendale Hotel. You'll hear all about that in this episode. So please check out his show. And I should mention, I forgot to mention this when I put up the Jane Caro episode that I also put up this morning, that I will be at Splendor in the Grass this weekend, not only enjoying some music, but I'll also be performing. I'm doing a comedy show, Will Anderson and Friends, with a bunch of the best young comedians from around Australia, new and emerging comedians who are going to be performing on that show. And, you know, little old me, old man Ando as well. I am the Will Anderson bit. They are the Friends. It is a Saturday night and Sunday night. I think it starts at 5, goes through to about 7:30. So not up against too many of the big bands. And that should be really great fun. So if you want to come down and see some great stand-up comedy, come and check us out at Splendor in the Grass. Okay, that's it. I'm not going to bang on anymore in this one because I want to get it up as soon as possible. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks to Ryan for being part of it. We had a great time. And had some beers beforehand, had some beers afterwards. Nearly did a whole podcast either side of the podcast, but we very much enjoyed this. It was the first time that we had actually met, even though we had been speaking online for a while. So really interesting podcast, really fun guy, and please check out Clever Man and support Clever Man. And look, I don't know if there'll be one up in 2 weeks or whether this has to... I don't know. Don't ask me questions I don't know the answer to. I hope you enjoyed this one. I'll talk to you again soon. So. Welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. Now, this may be the first Philosophy I've ever recorded in a pub. So this is out the back of a pub, the Chippendale Hotel in Sydney, which I'm going to give a plug to, because not only do they do an excellent mac and cheese, which I eat quite a lot because it's quite next to my offices for Gruen, but also we're out the back tonight and they did turn down their music so we could record this and still drink beer and didn't have to go back to the office. So I'm very grateful of that. So a big shout out to the Chippendale Hotel. This is Philosophy. I have a guest here with me, and as is tradition, on this podcast, guest, who are you?
I'm Ryan Griffin. I'm an Aboriginal man, also writer and a director, and the original concept creator of Clever Man.
Okay, that's a pretty good summary. I like that. And I'm glad you didn't stop with Iron Ryan Griffin, because then people might have thought you were the footballer.
The football player.
Ryan Griffin, who used to be the captain of my football team and then came to GWS. So
oh, really?
This would have been a very bitter podcast when I accused him of breaking my heart, all podcasts.
It's funny, we have my girlfriend always says to me, because my son brought it up first, he told all his friends, like, oh, you know, my dad makes this TV show, I'll Google, and this football player came up. And all the friends didn't believe him. And so my girlfriend's like, well, you know, your goal is to just out-Google Ryan Griffin, the footballer.
Yeah, that's right. That's when you know that the show has really hit. Like, sure, yeah, we won some, like, you know, Emmys. And sure, we won some AFIs. Yeah. And sure, we've been, you know, I've been directing. But now that I'm a bigger Google search than Ryan Griffin.
That's when you've made it.
That's when you've made it.
Yeah.
Now, you are the creator of a TV show called Clever Man, which if people haven't had an opportunity to watch yet, I loved this show. Like, I mean, I've told you this already. I messaged you privately. The first time I saw it, I was in Barcelona in Spain, and I was watching it, I think illegally.
Yeah. Beautiful.
But I was so excited about it, and I'd heard so much about it in the lead up to it. And the interesting thing was, when I then went to America, it was easy for me to access it because it was playing over there on Sundance TV pretty much at the same time it must have been playing in Australia. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Just literally a few hours before. You know, it's the closest that you can sort of go day and date. So there was about 9 hours difference between when they aired and when we aired.
Is that right? Now, was it airing in America first or here?
Yeah,
first?
Well, that's the only way we could do it without it waiting a whole day. Like, they wanted to close the window as much as possible.
Right.
And so originally, because the ABC had always backed it, had picked it up first. But to make sure that everyone sort of goes out at the same time, we had to give it them to go first and then us 9 hours later.
Right. So we were getting an Australian show direct from America.
Correct.
And this is an amazing show. We'll get to it in a minute because I do want to talk very much about the show and the process of making the show and how, you know, your life has changed so much and so quickly because of this show. But this podcast, I always ask people, do they have a philosophy? So it's nice to get to that early so that we can then funnel the rest of the conversation through that if you have one. Do you have one?
Yeah, I guess for me, it is about... for me, it's always about finding something that's fun or that makes you happy. You know, for a while, I suffered from depression heavily. And for me, it was once I got past... You know, the thing of not letting stuff affect me, that's when things change. So whenever I get into situations that I go like, fuck, this isn't fun, I'm not enjoying myself, I would get stuck. And I think once I got past that and I knew, hey, this is just a passing phase, or this is just something I have to deal with now, then it was everything became clear. And actually, that's sort of when Clever Man started to push. I just sort of forgot about everything else and started worrying about what I wanted and what makes me happy.
Well, talk me through that, because I mean, I know we're diving in the deep end on that one, but
yeah,
you know,
straight in there.
Anyway, are you still depressed then? But talk to me about that, because like, to people out there, like, sometimes I think when people say, because I've been very lucky that, you know, I have a job that even though I work really hard, like, it doesn't feel like work because it's fun. You know, I love doing my job, and you are able to throw yourself into your job when you do love doing it. But I think sometimes people like mistake the idea of fun, or they have a different idea of what fun is, and the idea that maybe fun isn't compatible with actually producing good work. So how did you come to that revelation? Talk me through, like, you know, how you started to kind of get that idea.
I think for me, you know, it was sort of something that I suffered with for about 7 or 8 years that I didn't tell anyone. I didn't want to talk. I didn't even want to talk about it.
Okay.
And it's interesting now that I've sort of come out of that storm where people are like, oh, you've changed. Like, you were a different person. There was a period in your life that you weren't you. You know, I have someone that, you know, was my next door neighbor growing up. I consider him my brother. And he said, look, I didn't know you for 7 years. You know, we didn't keep in contact. And I think for me, it was a part of, you know, separating from an older relationship and realizing the goals that I wanted in life, realizing the things that I wanted to do for my son, and then starting to do that. And, you know, like, you know, while I was getting Clever Man up, I was folding clothes in a warehouse.
Right.
Just so I could have a place that was my own, that was close to the city, so I could pursue this. And I knew that going to this warehouse, that wasn't me, I wasn't enjoying it, but folding the clothes, it just let me think about, okay, I'm doing this to get happy, you know, just folding each clothes. And then when the show started to roll out, I was like, okay, this is fine, like, I've just got to push past all that sort of shit.
That's really amazing. So tell me the story of Clever Man, how it became, because we were just having a beer before this when we were deciding whether we would go to the office or not, and then
beers went out.
And yeah, I was like, I was willing really to record over the music just so that we can stay here and have beers, but luckily they turned it off. You were saying to me that originally, well, tell people about where you were at, like, pre-Clever Man, because for most people, I guess, this is the first time they will have ever, you know, heard of you.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess, like, I grew up in the Blue Mountains, west of Sydney. For me, I grew up in a predominantly white town. You know, I was the only Aboriginal kid in my school that identified. And, you know, there were a couple that I knew that didn't put their hand up.
Kept it on the DL.
And that was tough. It was, you know, there was parts where you come across, like, casual racism. You know, like, you know, I remember going to some of my closest friends' houses and their mums giving me plastic cups while the rest had glass and things like that, you know, just sort of going... Wow. And for me, I was just like, okay, well, at first it was like, well, that was part of my life. I was like, well, that's how it's got to be.
As a kid, are you aware that that is what it is? Or is it only something that in reflection as you get older that you get a more of an awareness of what was going on at those times?
I think it's a bit of both, actually. Yeah. I think early on, my dad sort of let me get to that myself. Like, he wasn't sort of going around saying, you know, be proud, be black. You know, he was sort of letting me come to it. And I think when he started to understand that, that's where, you know, I was starting to own my identity. I remember once I was playing basketball at the time, and I took my shoes off. I've got quite flat feet, and someone said, "Oh, well, you got boom feet." And at first I was like, "Oh," and my dad was there, and my dad waited for this guy to leave, and he's like, "It's all right for you to say something. Like, if someone says something, you don't have to take it on the chin." And I think a part of me, you know, I was probably, you know, 13 at the time. And I guess that had positive effects and negative effects, because I guess from then I sort of took, if anyone said anything, I should punch them.
Right. You know? Dad's like, "I said you could say something. I didn't say you could belt them in the face."
Exactly. So it did have its pros and cons. But I guess for me it was like, okay, well, it's where I can start to own my Aboriginality, you know, like...
Did the other kids have an awareness of... Because how old are you, if you don't mind me
I'm
asking?
I'm 33.
Okay, so you're like a 10 years essentially younger than me. I'm 42. But, like, you know, that's a decent enough amount of time. I remember when I was at school, we had a friend who was not Indigenous, but I think Islander or, you know, Poland. I'm not quite sure, and I don't want to speculate for the sake of, you know, getting into a terrible... But his nickname at primary school was Chico, you know, like the little... The jelly babies.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a kid, it never occurred to me that that was like a, in any way, like, because he thought, you know, well, to us, you know, to our world, that was his nickname.
Yeah,
He thought it was funny. None of us seemed to be saying it with any hatred in our heart. And it's only like, you know, as an adult that I've kind of come to awareness of, you know what, I mean,
yeah,
shit
exactly.
Like that was happening much more often than I would have imagined. Did the other kids have an awareness of, like, what was the way that the other kids kind of reacted?
Look, I think a lot of them didn't understand what they were saying. It was interesting. I wrote an article for The Guardian just before Cleverman came out, and I had two friends message me and go, because I talked about the plastic cups, I talked about hearing people say, you know, Abba or Boom, and I had two friends come back and goes, "That wasn't me, was it? Like, if so, I apologize. Like, I don't..." You know, and I'm like, no, because I would have let you know.
Yeah. Did I punch you? Probably wasn't
then
you.
Then it wasn't you.
Yeah.
No, but, like, I think there's times where you would just realise, fuck, I've got to stand up and say something. Like, I've got to do something. Like, I remember starting rugby and meeting a group of guys. They were all, you know, white guys. And... one guy's nickname was Abbo, and I'm like, what are you guys calling him?
Right.
And they're like, "Oh, well, he just looks it." And I'm like, "Well, I just want to let you guys know I'm Abbo." And they stopped saying that. But it's sort of that environment that they're in that it was okay because there was no one pulling them up on it, you know. So I think, you know, being in an environment where everyone's predominantly white, racism just slides over and forgets if no one pulls them up. And a lot of these people, you know, are my friends, and we've grown, and I've taught them, hey, don't say that, don't do this. And I know for a fact, if we were ever in a pub and someone said that to me, they'd be the first person to jump in. So I think it was just part of the environment that we grew up in.
Do you think that Australians are in no... this is a leading question, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
But, there's part of me that thinks that, at least with the Pauline Hansons of the world, their racism is on Front Street. Like, you can see exactly where they're coming from, and, you know, it's like they're basically just saying, here's what I believe, and it's out in the open, and blah, blah, blah. Whereas sometimes I feel like people who consider themselves to be, you know, small-L liberal, like, you know, left-wing people or whatever, that there's that the casual racism that
Australia's
is almost...
Australia's casual racism is on point.
Right.
Like, it is.
Number one? Would you say we're number one in the world?
I think we're pretty good at it. And I think the thing is that being someone, being a light-skinned Aboriginal person,
yeah,
I get to see the both sides of the coin. You know, like, you can enter a room and people say something that they wouldn't say in front of a black man.
Right.
But until you get pulled up on it, and then they tell you, they get checked straight away. You know, and it's funny, you know, my girlfriend, she's from Birmingham, so, and she always, and she says to me, she's like, oh, Ryan, you always point out, you know, whether it's a black, whether they're black or white, or you always go back to identity or this. And I go, well, that's because it's such a big thing in this country that we just, you know, we tend to be racist when we don't try to be.
What do you think? I mean, obviously, this is a massive question and there is no, you know, one answer to it. But I just like to hear what you think. I sometimes feel like I don't know what the way forward is in this country. And it disappoints me in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, we have the, you know, world's oldest, you know, living people here on this, like, you know, land, who have this, like, incredibly rich history, which is something that, you know, you explore so well in your show, yeah. Like, but that we can't seem to embrace in the way that other countries have, you know, made peace with and embraced their stories. Like, yeah. I can only think of our country going, if I look at our ideal country, don't we want to have a country where our original people are as, you know, as... God, it's so hard to, yeah, but have as much opportunity and as much of a part of our society and as much a chance to be success, if not more, than the rest of us. Wouldn't that only make us a better country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, for me, I'll sort of go back to sort of high school. For me, being at high school, all I wanted to do was be there to party.
Right.
I wasn't there for an education. My teachers knew it. And one teacher... She was my history teacher. She put me aside and she's like, look, you know, if you pay attention to history, you'll get a lot out of it. And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. I would sit at the back of the class and just, you know, make smart-ass comments. And then she pointed me out and she go, and we're talking about the Arab-Israeli conflict. And she asked a question to me. She goes, so Ryan, what would you do to stop the Arab-Israeli conflict? And I was like, what? Are you seriously asking me that question?
Right. Be great if you came up with a perfect response.
Yeah, if you could just sort that out and write it in a letter.
Yeah.
And she goes, because I want to know that because it could help in Australia. And I sat back. I was like, fuck, she's kind of got a point there. It's sort of, there. How do we treat people that have, you know, deep-seated hatred towards each other because of history? You know, I'm sitting in a class full of a bunch of white followers, but we get on fine. What's stopping everyone else to go forward in that way? And I said, look, I don't know. I said, I guess in a way to start with the kids. And she said, well, how do you do that? And I'm like, you get them both in the room and you just play Lego together. And she's like, okay, that's great, but how do you stop the parents when they get home? And I, you know, I kept on getting like brick walls. I think it's such a hard road to cross because there's so many. It's like playing Frogger. There's so many obstacles to get to where you want to go. For me, it is just starting to get more of our culture in people's faces.
Right.
Get it more accepted. I use everyone sort of asking, you know, in respects to Clever Man. You know, it's great to sort of see this on screen. How come we haven't had it before and all this sort of stuff? And I don't think we could have had it before because we didn't have the roads pay for us. When you look in the States, you know, they had black comedy or, you know, African-American comedies on screen like Sanford and Sons and, you know, The Cosby Show. And, you know, these were early on that helped pave the way to... And I think, you know, The Cosby's a good example... Probably not now.
No,
but
I mean, it's a tougher example now. Yeah. But you know, let's forget the events of the last. For the context of this anecdote,
Is if you have a look at it, that family could have been a white family,
right?
You know, as a, you know, in a stereotype. Yeah, yeah, no, it was, I mean, all the kids went to university, and it broke the stereotype that everyone's like, well, you know, black people don't have a job, they don't got an education, but they broke that mold where it sort of said, we're just exactly like you guys. And we kind of haven't had that here in Australia. We haven't had, you know, shows that have just been ours. You know, over the last few years we have. And I think...
Who did you look up to? Like, as someone who, like, you know, obviously got interested at some stage. Well, who did you look up to as a teenager? Was it sports people? Was it... Because to me, when I think of Indigenous, like, leaders, the first thing, you know, I mean, and it's not an uncommon story around the world, by the way. Like, one of the best ways for, you know, African-American youth to get out of poverty still in America is through sports, music, or education. They're your three kind of ones. And sports and music are normally the fast track out of there. In Australia, I mean, you know, if you look at the rugby league or the AFL, these are industries where 10% of the workforce can be Indigenous and they can be earning hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And there doesn't seem to be that sort of opportunity for Indigenous people in many other industries. Yeah. So was it sports people that you looked up to, or was it not Indigenous people at all
I think it was more non-Indigenous people, because I guess for me, being in a white environment, I don't have access to that sort of stuff, you know, and it wasn't... Again, it wasn't something, you know, it was something my dad wanted me to find myself. He didn't want to force it on me. But I guess for me, it was about, like, you know, the same teacher, she introduced me to, like, the civil rights movement. She taught me about the Northern Ireland conflict. You know, these were all conflicts that I could relate to that treated a minority in a way that they had to fight back. And I guess for me, it wasn't until, you know, I was in my mid-20s where I was like, I really started to pursue that sort of stuff, because, you know, I would not want to meet who I was when I was 16 to 21. I was a prick, and I admit it. And it's interesting when we're in the writer's room and I tell stories about, you know, as a kid, I'm like, all right, so don't take this as who I am now, but... And then we tell the story, but...
Do you think, based on that, that, and I often think this, that we judge people way too harshly, like, for things they do when they're 15, 16, absolutely, 17, but also the pressure that we put on people, like, to decide what they're going to do with their life. You know, this schooling system where we kind of convince these kids that, you know, your results at the end of some exams you have when you're 17 are going to determine what you do for the rest of your life.
For me, like I said, I went to school to party on weekends. I never had an idea that I wanted to be in this industry. I never had an idea that I was like wanted to be a labourer, a teacher, whatever. I was like, I want to party with my mates, go and play some footy, probably get into a fight or two, and then do the same thing the next weekend. And then, you know, I finished high school. I'm like, all right, well, I needed to find something else to do. And I went and did a film course in Redfern.
Now, how did you get to the film course? Like, what made you think I'm going to go and do a film course?
My dad, he was the director of that TAFE at the time, so he sort of ran.
So nepotism is what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. and he sort of said, you know, like, you need to do something. You can't stay in this house and not do anything. And he gave me a list of things, and I'm like, oh, film looks all right.
Yeah.
But then, like, it's funny because then I looked at that, and then I started to do that. And then I just looked back at all the things I connected to when I was younger. I was like, well, it kind of makes sense, you know? Right. Like, I couldn't read or write all the way, like, up to high... Like, I could, but just barely. Like, I just scraped by all the way through high school. You know, they were still trying to teach me to read in high school. And comics and TV shows were the only thing I could connect to. And then when I started to work more into this and... I started to read more than I ever read before, you know. I started to read anything that I could get my hand on. I read the Bible, I read the Quran, like, just to push myself. And then...
That's interesting to me. Did you read them cover to cover, the Bible and the Quran?
No, that was
you...
fucking hard read.
I was about to say, there'd be Christians and Muslims who haven't read either of those books.
It is hard. It was ridiculously hard. Like, and then you get to points where you go... I'll skip a few.
Yeah, you know, like, I got the gist. Blah, blah, blah. Be nice to people.
They're just going through everyone's name. And Isaac Begot. I was like, okay. Oh, I'm still going.
I get the gist. Who's the one that I need to know about?
Yeah, exactly.
So not enough previously ons. Let's just cut to the chase.
Exactly. And I think that's when everything started to open up more. And I started to watch more film and TV than I found my passion. I found the thing I like. Wow, this could, you know, imagine if...
And what stuff did you like? I mean, like, you talk about comics, you talk about, like, films, those sort of things. Like, what what particular characters, what particular writers, what particular films, you know, what stuff really connected with you?
I guess I wanted to go through just like I wanted to go on the journey of cinema. So I started to watch old stuff, you know, and then genre. Like growing up for me, I watched, you know, I'm a massive Batman fan, I'm a massive Ninja Turtle fan. You know, I remember.
So the Ninja Turtles, was that the comic books that first got you into it, or the early movie?
It was actually the cartoon series. Oh, yeah. I remember
the cartoon series was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was weird because I still remember the day that I stumbled across it. I can't even remember the show that we were going to watch.
Right.
Went over to my next door neighbor's house. There was a show that we always watched at this time, and they said whatever
today's
show
blah, blah, blah,
was isn't
be
playing
on.
Because. We're showing Ninja Turtles. I'm like, okay, what's this? And we watched it, and I just lost my shit. And we went out in the backyard, you know, ripped all sticks up and started to smack each other with sticks. And for me, I was just like, okay, this is interesting. I really got connected to that. And it wasn't until I could start reading better that I started to get the old, like, the graphic novels and the comics and all that sort of stuff, where I'm like, this world's just exciting. You know, I think the first book that I ever read front to back was the book adaptation of the movie Hook by Steven Spielberg.
The Hook book.
And it was just
but
like...
you didn't read Peter Pan.
I didn't read Peter Pan.
No, you read...
What's Peter Pan?
Yeah, you didn't read...
I read Hook, which I already had seen the movie of.
Right.
So...
Rufio.
That was the... that was the, exactly. I was like, where's Rufio?
Yeah, where's Rufio?
Bangarang! but like that was the first thing, and I was like, okay, I can do this.
Right.
I still often, like, when I'm writing on a script, I still, and I'm sure, like, you know, our editors of the scripts and that comes back, it's probably littered with spelling mistakes, but they get the gist of what I'm trying to say.
Plus, you know, there's spell check now.
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
fine.
Exactly.
Plus, you can always do the thing that if the Americans read it, go, oh, no, that's how we spell it in Australia,
that's
mate.
That's Aboriginal dialect.
Yeah, that, mate. Oh, are you being racist? No, that's
exactly.
Oh, sorry, mate. Oh, you
it's
spell
the, it's a roll of the tongue.
You know what,
you're getting
mate?
It wrong.
You spell it your white man's way, but if you want to oppress me, but this is how I spell.
Exactly. Exactly. it's funny, I remember one day, someone, this is probably when I was a lot younger, someone got me to spell Indigenous, and I was like, I don't know how to spell that. And they go, "What? How do you not know how to spell?" I'm like, well, it's your language.
Yeah, we didn't call ourselves Indigenous.
Exactly.
It's interesting to me that, I was reading something that I think it was that Luke Pearson wrote about the idea that when, you know, not only that when the First Fleet came, you know, came to Australia, and the fact that Indigenous people, you know, Aboriginal people, it never occurred to me as a child that Aboriginal was, of course, a label that was put on by the outside. It was like, you know, it was just like them coming to Australia and calling them trees or whatever. It was just a name. It wasn't their name. It wasn't what they called themselves.
Yeah,
it wasn't how they identified. And the fact that you, not only has your home been invaded by this other force, but then they've labelled you and given you a new name and a new story. It must be, how much of that did you know that you were aware of at high school? Or when was it that you became really aware of, like, you know, the white history of Australia and the fact and the effect that it had on Indigenous people?
Yeah, I think for me it was later, and you know, it was, you know, around like 17, 18 when I wanted to, when I could read, where I was like, you know what, I can go get a book, I can go look on the internet, I can read and I can research myself. And reading a lot of things, you know, like I remember reading stuff that I'd go back and tell my friends, that, you know, like, do you know there's stories that have been written down of white fellas kicking babies' heads off? And they're like, no, that wouldn't happen. I'm like, no, like, have you read anything? You know, just they're thinking that no atrocities happened. It was just, you know, a takeover and that was it. And for me, I guess that's when I was like, you know what, I want to do as much as I can here. And I think that journey for me is how I deal with my son differently than my dad does.
Yeah, so that's interesting to me. And I was going to ask you about that, if you're happy to talk that, is how do you, what is your philosophy in regard to him knowing those things?
Yeah, look, I think you know, he's lighter skinned than I am. His mother is also, you know, Aboriginal, light skinned Aboriginal. And I guess for me, like when I was growing up, I could say to someone, you know, I'm a buck fella, and they're like, yeah, they'd debate it until they saw my dad.
Right.
And then they accepted it. You know, it was like I was bullshitting them until they saw my dad.
You were basically an Andrew Bolt column.
Yeah, exactly.
Until they saw your dad.
Exactly. And for my son, he's never going to get that opportunity. Like, right. You know, he can debate it. And then they'll see me and they'll still debate it. And, for, you know, he's only nine, but he calls himself a blackfella. You know, he always talks about, you know, when there's stuff at school, he'll put his hand up if it's to do with, you know, Aboriginality or anything like that. He'll go, yep, I'll be the forefront of that. And that was the big push for me, for Cleverman, was to give him something that he could own. That doesn't matter what all these people would have a go at him. He'd just like, you know, fuck your opinion. I know who I am, and move forward. Where it took me a while to get to that point, and that was the big push for me for Cleverman. You know, and it was just realizing how much he loves superheroes. I was like, all I need to do is make a black superhero for him, and that will give him the push forward. And it's interesting. It was only a couple of weeks ago now. My son's new love is WWE wrestling. He loves it.
Okay, sure.
Loves it.
Yep.
And I walked into his bedroom, bought him like a big bed, and he's there wrestling a pillow. I'm like, what are you doing, bud? I'm like, what the hell is going on? He had like a, you know, one of those Mexican wrestling masks on, and the theme of Cleverman was playing in the background. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm wrestling. I'm like, yeah, but why you got that on? He's like, oh, I'm Cleverman.
Right.
That's my wrestling
name. That's my character.
I'm the Cleverman. Yeah. And I come out to that.
You play the theme music.
Yeah,
you come
exactly.
out to the music.
And I was just like,
that would be good music to come out to as
yes,
a wrestler,
absolutely.
By the way.
And I was just like, fuck, that's it. Like,
right.
That was the aim.
Spark the imagination.
And that's all.
Gave them the opportunity to make up their own stories with the characters
exactly.
you've created.
Yeah. And that's all I wanted to do is like have this show in some way empower people.
Right.
And to see that in my son, I was just like, well.
Well, I think it very much achieves that. Like, you know, and that's only one of many things that it does achieve, but I think that's probably the one that you can be most confident
that it
does achieve,
well,
is that it, like, you know, you've created that opportunity for those stories to be cool and to capture their imagination and for people to, you know, for kids, because that's the thing about kids. When kids are playing, you know, cowboys and Indians, which, oh, well, that's probably culturally insensitive. <these days. laughs> cowboys and native. No, anyway, don't play that one. Let's not play that one at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, if they're playing Batman and Robin, or if they're playing Superman and Batman or whatever, they're not acting out storylines from the movie or the comic book. They're making up their own stories that have those characters. And, you know, to give them characters, you know, that they can identify with and relate to, I mean, is a great gift to a generation. So let's now talk about Cleverman then and how it came about, because it's a really interesting story about how even the show came about. You said originally it wasn't going to be what it was. So talk us through where you're at, like, you know, where you had the original idea and how that became Cleverman.
So it actually goes all the way back to... It goes back to Ninja Turtles, actually.
Oh, okay, here we go. Good.
It was something that I
you met a giant talking rat.
I like to force onto my son the love of my things onto him. But he really loved the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
And I've actually got a video of the day that I sort of knew that I wanted to tell a story like this, of my son dressed up as a Ninja Turtle. He was dressed up as Raphael. And I'm fighting him with like an egg lifter, a spatula. We're hitting around, and we're mucking around with that. And you know, he fell on the ground. He was really like role playing the Ninja Turtles. And we finished that, and he went to bed. And I sat there. I was like, if I could create a superhero for him, or something that he could pretend to play, he can connect to culture. So we first started this. I pitched the idea to the company Goalpost Pictures, who I was an intern for at the time.
So when you were an intern, how does the internship work in Australia? Is that unpaid or is that a paid internship?
Well, that was a paid one, because I went through the Screen Australia at the time. Well, it was AFC at the time. and I was dealing with Sally Riley, who's now working for the ABC. And I said to her, I'm like, look, you know, I want to... They first asked me, what do you want to do? And I'm like, well, to be fair, I don't watch much Australian television, so I can't give you the things that you want to hear. Like, I just want to make genre. I want to make big action movies. I want to make this. And they said, well, look, if we can put you on a few projects and see how you feel. And I worked on a small telly movie with Gold Coast Pictures as an attachment. And that's only, you know, only a small paid job. You go in and do some stuff. And they sort of said, look, if you want to do a longer period, we can see what we can do. So it was a Screen Australia funded for me to do a year's internship there.
Okay, fantastic.
And so while I was there, I was doing working on a kids show with them called Lockie Leonard.
I've heard of it. I must admit, it'd be weird for me. I don't have kids, so if I was dropping into Lockie Leonard, it'd probably be a red flag on my computer or something, I think.
You're now one of the dots on the screen. No, I think, like, we were over there, and it was a boozy lunch on one of the days off, and one of the partners said to me, so what do you want to do, Ryan? I just said, look, I'd like to make a superhero for my son, an Aboriginal superhero. And I just left it at that. It wasn't like a formal pitch or anything like that. And excuse me, after we got back, because it was shot in WA, we came back and they said, look, would you want to formally pitch that idea? And so, you know, mocked together a document. It was originally called Dreamtime Detectives, and it was aimed at a kids market. And I pitched it to them, and they said, "Look, we'd love to help you do it. Like, you know, let's work something out." And my time there was finishing up, and so they said, "Look, maybe we could go back to Screen Australia and say, look, we want to do another year. If they pay for some of it, you know, Screen Australia pays for it, but then I can work on this and any other project at the same time." And so we started to develop it up, and the more that we worked in that realm, the more that we realised it was too hard to tell these stories in a kid's world. You know, like, you know, if they're teaching kids not to steal or whatever, they'd go to the river, steal some fish, and then someone would kill them. And you're like, well, I can't really put that on ABC3. The kid steals a Snickers and then gets stabbed. Like, we figured that we had to...
I would love that.
Exactly.
I would love that. That should be like ABC5.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, some real life lessons for children.
Exactly. And then we took it back to Sally Riley, and she said, you know what, if you want to age it up and keep pushing it, throw a whole heap of sex and violence in there and it might be something for us. And I think that was our first jump off. We were like, wow, we can really push this. We can really go and tell everything that we wanted to tell politically, you know, also all the shows that I watch, we could do all that now.
So what shows were you watching? What were the things that, you know, you were kind of inspired by?
I think not many people remember this, I guess, but like when I was young, I used to watch this show called Tour of Duty. It was an old war TV show. I think it was about Vietnam.
Okay.
And it was something that me and my next door neighbour would go out. You know, I shouldn't have been watching it. Like, I know that, like, his family would record it. They'd go, I'm going next door to play. And then we'd put it on and watch it. And then we'd go in the backyard and shoot. And for me, it was like, at the time, it was kind of edgy. Like, it was, you know, they had the race issue of you know, white soldiers fighting next to black soldiers. You know, it was quite graphic, and I was just like, okay, that's kind of what I want to do. I want to really push the boundaries. And then, you know, the more that we started to delve into the story, I just bring up everything I watch. You know, I guess the way that I work in the writer's room is I will talk about other shows or other movies that I've seen, and I'll talk about a scene. It's like the essence of this scene, but let's put it in our world. Yeah. So we'll talk about one thing where the subtext is this, and then we'll do our twist on it. Or we'll combine that with stories from me growing up. Like, for example, in our first episode, there's a story of these kids stealing rims and putting it on the doc's car.
Yeah.
That's a true story.
Okay, right.
So it was sort of, you know, trying to find those sort of, those things that worked for us, but putting twists on it.
I mean, the interesting thing to me, just before we get to the kind of the themes that run through the program, is just from people who are listening to this from a creator's point of view, like from a creative and artist's point of view, the idea that a show that feels as complete, like Clever Man to me feels like the show it always was. And I think sometimes in entertainment, we forget that like a show like that may have not started that. As complete as it feels now, and as much as you feel like, oh, this must have arrived fully formed as this idea, it wasn't that idea at all. What's that process like when you suddenly are like, oh, this thing that I thought was the thing that I was putting all my energy into, I've realized, were you happy to pivot or was that hard?
It's the toughest thing you do. I think, you know, to let go of your personal ideas and to start listening to other people. And also, I think a part of me, again, is just the way that I grew up and arguing and fighting with people. Some of that sometimes come into the room. I kind of don't have a filter sometimes. So someone will pitch something, go, oh, well, that's shit. And I was like, oh, okay, I probably shouldn't say it like that. Yeah. I'm like, oh, we should do it a different way. So, you know, a lot of the rooms were sometimes they were beautiful, fun, you have a laugh. There's ways you can get stuff off your chest. You're like, you know, this just stays in the room.
Uh-huh.
You know, but then there's other times where everyone in the room has a different opinion and you all argue and you argue and you just try and get past that point. I think one of the big things for me and was one of my sticking points was and one that I you got to pick your battles and you got to say, well, I'll let that slide, I'll let this one slide. For me, I would always say I don't want to make Australian television. That was the one thing that I'd always argue about, and we'd get to things and I go, it feels like Australian television. And they go, why? Why? Right.
And what would those things be? What are your red flags? Like when you say, I don't want to make Australian television, I mean, it may be just a sense that you have, but are there certain things that you go, that's a red flag for me?
For me, it's simple, straightforward storytelling where you don't get the audience to work.
Right.
You know, like you get, you know that, or we've got 45 minutes left and we haven't resolved stuff, shit's going to happen in the next 5 minutes and then, you know, we'll get a resolve. You know, I would always say, you know, I go, look, we don't have to do that, but just imagine if we sat in a car park for 20 minutes.
Right.
And just have these characters talk at each other. That's something that we haven't seen before, you know. That's something that we can push the boundaries of. Or let's try and twist the way that we tell the story. Let's you know, really fuck with the structure.
I won't get spoilers. I won't give any spoilers because, like, I hope that there probably is like an untapped audience of people out there that haven't seen the show yet, who hopefully are going to go away and watch it. But I was talking to you earlier when we were just having a chat about it off air that there is a thing that happens in the final episode where the show, I mean, it doesn't completely shift, but there's certainly like you've got an ace up your sleeve that you've kind of been keeping till that moment.
Yeah,
and you said that was a very considered method of telling that story.
Yeah, I think you know, we'd always talk about because we're trying to make something different. If we start our show at the big stuff that the things we want to change in the industry, people are going to switch off because they're not used to it. So if we slowly build them up and throw a few things out here and there, they start to relate to it, or they get to know the characters, that when you just fuck stuff up for them, they'll go on that journey because they want to know more. They want to know what else is going to happen. And I think it was hard because I think we had writers that had been working in the Australian industry for years, you know, longer than I had been alive. So it was like, you know, it's hard for me to come in and say that doesn't feel right because they've got more experience than me. But it's also a gut feeling to me going, but there's a reason why I feel it's wrong.
So how do you negotiate that? Because I've been in those situations in my past as well where at the end of the day, it's your, like, I mean, it's up to you for it to be your vision, but at the same time, you're working in a team environment and sometimes there are people on that team who do have more experience than you have. How do you get to that point where, and how do you negotiate that point where someone who does have more experience is saying one thing and your gut is saying another thing, to know whether you should trust your gut in that situation or whether you should trust the experience in that situation?
I think it's trial and error.
Right.
I think you... I do think me in the writer's room this season is a lot different than the me a year ago.
Uh-huh. You know, in what ways?
I think I'm more open to letting people run on an idea.
Mm.
I'm more open to arguing and then dropping back and then just letting people go. You know, like we've had heated moments this season, but we come back into the room and we know what we want to make. And I think you've got to find the people that you can argue with and then come to work the next day and then go, it was what it was.
Well, there's probably a difference between arguing with you both wanting the result of moving forward.
Yeah, exactly.
This is one of my problems I have, to be honest, with public discourse these days, is that so many of the television shows that purport to be, you know, conversations about us moving forward together are really just two diametrically opposed sides that are never going to agree yelling at each other.
Yeah.
And I think there is a difference between, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a different opinion or... I mean, quite often in a Gruen meeting, I will fight passionately for an idea and then at the end agree with the other person. Like,
yeah,
I just need to argue it out first.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Go, no.
I've
given you all my best arguments and I believe that you are right.
Yeah, totally.
Just needed to hear them out loud.
It is very much like that. And I think once you realise you can do that and you've got a team that you can do that with, that's when it becomes easier. I think, and again, I think it's also a part of, you know, I said earlier, I think it's a part of, you know, who I was growing up. You know, like, I felt like I always had to argue with someone. Or always had to, you know, if push came to shove, then one of us is going to throw a punch and we'll deal with it that way. And it is getting past that and going, all right, let's talk it through like adults and let's really think about how this is going to work.
Has that been something that you've really had to consciously make an effort to do, though? Like, do you feel like it's just something that has naturally come to you as you've got more experience, or is there times when you have, like, had to kind of institute a technique to deal with it, or, like, to literally remind yourself today, you know, when I go into this meeting, I'm going to behave in this sort of way? I don't know.
A part of me always says, don't lose that.
Yeah.
Because that's what makes me in that
right.
room.
Well, because that's the thing as well. You don't want to lose... who you are.
Yeah. And I think what you do is I sometimes just try and word it differently but still have the energy that I would, right. you know. I'm probably the person who swears the most in that room.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's just me trying to get my point across. But I think that was the way that I was dealing with it, then sort of attacking someone. You know, or I just, you know, I think now I'll sit back and I'll listen to someone's complete argument where I would usually go and shoot it down a sentence or two in.
Right.
And so I think for me, I've really enjoyed this because of that. Like, I think there's the more that you do these rooms, the more that you're going to realise, you know, the reason why people are in this industry for, you know, so many years is they do have the experience and, yeah, I'm going to learn from them. But at the same time, I feel like they can learn from me.
Oh, and I mean, if you've got the best people, you know, like if someone's come to write on your show, a lot of the time it's because they love your vision or your idea and they want to work in the service of that vision or that idea, and you just have to access the best way for them to do that. So tell me then about, so one of the most fascinating things to me about Clever Man is the layers of there about the Indigenous stories first and foremost, but then, you know, there's a very much a socio-political, satirical sort of aspect to the show as well. So where did that come from? What came first? Like, you know, how did that layer in? Like, you know, one of the things I'm most fascinated about is that some of these stories that you are using are stories that are very... that are very kind of special and intimate, and I can imagine that there perhaps was even some resistance from people in the Indigenous community to using these stories in this way. Was there?
Absolutely. I think, you know, like, we couldn't do this show without getting the permissions to do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think that's why we had so much issues with setting it as a kids show, because we're trying to bend these stories to that genre, where when we aged it up, we don't have to bend to anything. And, you know, I'd often go out to the communities and speak to the elders and say, this is what we wanted to do, this is how we want to do it. And first you go, to some of the communities, people didn't even know who I was.
Right.
So, you know, I had to go, well, this is my nan, she's here, you know her, I'm here to just, you know, connect with country, connect with you guys. And then we started to talk more, and then I talked to them why I wanted to make the show. That I wasn't here to rip them off. I wasn't here to steal their stories and make them my own. You know, I'd often say to them, like, imagine, you know, to a couple of the elders, I'd go, imagine if we could have our own Harry Potter. Right. And they'd all go, oh, Harry Potter! You know, they'd get all excited. And I said, yeah, but imagine if that was right. Our, like, that was our culture. And then, yeah. And then they started to get it. They started to go, oh, and then they'd open up more. And then, you know... but it's also, you know, we have that, and then we have the clever man stuff, which is real taboo in a lot of communities because it is men's business. So a lot of people don't even want to talk about it. You know?
Right. Tell me what men's business, what does that mean? I mean, I've heard the term, and heard secret women's business and all those things.
Yeah.
We hear these terms, but I'm not sure that I understand what it means.
So I guess in the terms of the clever man, the way I explain it to our international audience is I go, the clever man's kind of like the Pope of the dreaming.
Right.
You know, he's an appointed man that...
And the dreaming for, like, I mean, again, like, let's, yeah. you know, let's step through this because it's interesting,
yeah,
A,
yeah.
to me, but I hopefully to, you know, the international audience, yeah. as well. The dreaming is...
Is, I guess how I explain it,
yeah.
is everything. It's the past, present, and the future. It's the reason why, how I... open the door in the morning. It's what makes me make my decisions.
Mm-hmm.
It's my ancestors reaching out to me. It is creation. It's everything. I guess, you know, there's everyone has their own interpretation of it or have each country has their own rules around the dreaming.
Uh-huh.
But I guess, you know, one thing for me is like when we talk about it in the show, is it? We always talk about it as the dreaming and not the dream time.
Yeah. Now, so that's a distinction that is purposeful. And what is the purpose of that?
Well, for me, if we say it's the dream time, it sort of pigeonholes it as it's a creation.
Right.
You know, it was back then.
It happened.
It's not now.
Yeah. Back in the past.
Yeah. And yeah. And for me, it is about it's a spirituality. It's who you are. It's in Western terms, it's a religion.
Right.
I guess. And so the clever man is kind of the conduit between the present and the dreaming.
Uh-huh.
He was the person who could connect to, you know, why are you sick? Are you sick not because you ate something bad? Are you sick because you've done something that you shouldn't have done? And so, you know, we had to sort of... It's a role that is, you know, for my country, that, you know, there are countries out there that have women in this position.
Uh-huh.
But for me, it was a man who was appointed or who was chosen, sometimes chosen as a young kid or chosen later on in life. And
so kind of, I mean, a bit like the Dalai Lama in that sense, that it was someone who was actually
identified
or chosen.
A healer. Yeah. They were considered, there was someone with a gift to make sure that those around it were looked after, you know?
Uh-huh.
And sometimes... you know, there's stories of clever men who exploited that gift, and so they were bad. So there's all different elements to it. But the big thing for me with the show was that was the first thing to go post-colonization. You know, because you're introducing a religion.
Right.
And they're going, there's this greater being. Who the fuck's this crazy guy who thinks that there's this thing called the dreaming, and he has these special powers to make you feel better? You know, so religion was sort of the first thing to sort of remove that role, and we
luckily we've moved past the fact where we divide our country on religion.
Exactly.
It's not a problem anymore.
Oh, no,
so
it doesn't affect
I mean back
decisions.
Then sorry about what happened, but now we're absolutely
we're
fine, everything's
slate,
fine,
man.
It's good.
You know, like there was parts of that is what we wanted to touch on in the first episode, you know, like even our character Waru talks about Uncle Jimmy being off the rails, you
right.
know, because sometimes even our own culture makes people believe that that position isn't relevant anymore.
Yeah.
So it was things like that we really wanted to bleed in. And I think that was quite one of the hardest things to put through in the writer's room, you know, because there are things that you want to tell in a genre or a superhero story. Like, you want to see someone get the powers, go through training, to get to where they want to go.
Right.
But we can't show that because it's culturally sensitive.
Right.
So we're just like, and people are like, well, how does he become the clever man? How do we show that? Do we get to see him start learning? And I was like, nope.
No clever man training montage.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. Yeah. You know, so we had to scratch, you know, so many 80s soundtracks off our list.
It's interesting to me, though, that because clearly that was something that was very important to you. That, but it's hard when you're making a balance between you're trying to make a television show, because at the end of the day, you're still telling a story. This is not a documentary about that time. You're using elements of that story, you know, in a broader sort of allegorical or metaphorical way, you know, and incorporating them in. But you are trying to be as respectful as possible of those stories and their meaning, you know, as well. So is there a time where you get pressure, you know, from people who don't understand the sensitivities about those sort of things?
Absolutely. And that's what happens in the room. Like, we'll get to points where we go, the room will pitch something and we start going down this route and I'm sitting there, I'm turning over my head, okay, can we do this? Can we do this? And then I was just like, if I feel like I don't have the answer, I just go, no, we can't do it. And then there'll be questions why and all this sort of stuff. Like, we have a creature in this show, in our first season, that has specific rules around it.
Uh-huh.
And so we'd get to the room, then we'd write this scene, and then the writers would come back and deliver it, and I'd read it through. I'm like, that sounds amazing, but it hasn't followed this rule, this rule, this rule. And everyone's like, fuck, all right, and then we have to go back and change it. I think it was quite exciting because what you have is it made everyone work harder, because you get to a point where you go, we can't tell this. We're going to have to do it a different way. Like, the biggest thing, and it's constantly debated, even for this season, is our creatures, the hairy men.
Uh-huh.
In the show, they say that they just arrived 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And everyone, like in the writer's room and even our audience today, go, where the fuck did they come from?
Yeah.
Where are you going to tell us? You're going to tell us. And I'm always debating it. I'm always saying, I don't want to say. I know why everyone wants to. There's two reasons for me. I want to hold it off until we know something that's really cool.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing for me is why I want to hold it off is because when these stories were told, they were told by elders, and the elders weren't to be questioned. So the hairies were up in the hill, and if you went there, the hairy men will get you. You don't put your hand up and go, where'd they come from? Why can't I go there? It's just they're there. Don't go there. Shut your mouth. And that's how you would play. And for me, I was just like, well, I don't want to know where they came from, because that's the story that I was told.
Oh, by the way, people always think they didn't want explanations for things.
Yeah.
But often when they're then given those explanations, they get really mad about the explanations.
Yeah,
see
exactly.
The whole last series of Lost. Well, you didn't want explanations then.
Yeah.
Just keep making up your own things. It's interesting to me, though, because obviously the hairies in the program act as an opportunity for you to really kind of debate, you know, roles of, like, you know, and kind of allegories between subhumans and bring in, like, you know, a lot of political issues there.
Yeah.
How do you balance, you know, the kind of social commentary, the political commentary with, you know, the rest of the show that you're making?
Yeah, I think for me, I'd always talk in the writer's room about the hairy men kind of being like X-Men. You know, they're our creature that we can say they're the other and let our audience decide who that other is.
Uh-huh.
Like, we had our premiere in Berlin, and when we went over there, that was like when the refugees were all coming into Germany, and they were just like, what is this, what you guys are trying to talk about? And I was like, no, I'm when I watch it, I see early colonization.
Right.
You know, I've had some fans come to me and talk about this being a gay-straight issue, you know? So, like, for me, it was always about just trying to show the other.
But also, like, an other that... And, like, it's interesting you mentioned the X-Men, because I did feel like there is definitely that theme of an other that are subjugating themselves when, if they really kind of unleash their power... You know, there's people within the community. And this, that's why I always loved X-Men, is because it's based on something real. Like, you know, originally the idea of X-Men was that you had, like, you know, you had Professor Xavier and you had Magneto, and they were two guys who were essentially trying to achieve the exact same thing, but through different methods. And it came out of, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Like, and you had two people who were trying to achieve the exact same thing, but just disagreed about the best methods to go about achieving that thing.
Yeah.
And a theme that constantly comes up, you know, in the X-Men is that Magneto thing of going, well, why are we letting them hunt us? Why are we letting them, you know, treat us like we're not special when we're super special?
Yeah.
If we actually use our powers, you know, we can do that. And I did certainly, like, notice that as, like, an underlying, which I liked a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, look, it's great that you say it like that and bring Martin Luther King and Malcolm X in, because that's exactly that exact same conversation is what we have in the room. We always go, which one is Cohen Malcolm X or is he Martin Luther King?
Right.
And is Waru his brother? You know, and we'd always play that back, but we always wanted to blur the lines between the two.
Well, I think that it does a very good job of doing that.
Yeah, and I think...
Like, I mean, the person who's meant to be the hero is largely... Yeah, unsympathetic for much of the first series.
Absolutely.
And the person who appears to be heroic,
yeah,
even when he's not, you kind of still get a real insight into that, you know, you do genuinely think he is trying to do the best for his community in the way that he perceives that to be, mixed up with his ego and all those things.
And I guess for me, when I look at those two characters, I see a bit of who I am today and who I was as a kid.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, you know, we would talk about, you know... doing things that, you know, I'm ashamed to say I did, but I don't hide it because I think if you hide it, you're kind of trying to hide that you did those sort of things.
Right.
You know, like, you know, I'd talk about in the room that there was a period there that I couldn't remember a weekend that I wasn't in a fight with a group of mates. And to be going out now, I'd be like, why would people do that? You know? And I think that's what we wanted to get in, especially the lead Cohen, was he has so many flaws and he has a history of just being a prick, but wanting to show his growth.
Do you think that people are scared of growing? Like, I mean, do you think that growing is a thing that people find, like, really confronting? I mean, I often think when it comes to, like, racism or homophobia or any of these things, I often feel people are so held back by the fact that, you know, like, they're not homophobic now, but they were once, like, said a lot of things about gay people.
Yeah,
so they feel like it's better to just never let it move on so they don't have to feel bad about what... Or, I mean, that's a very simplistic explanation, but I sometimes feel like that fear of growth is the thing
that
holds us back.
I have a friend, like, one of my closest friends, and we always catch up with a drink and stuff, and he'll always, you know, he'll throw in a racist comment towards me just to rib me. But he always, you know, he says to me, he's like, it's hilarious. He's like, I've seen you be a complete prick to people. I've seen you be, you know, racist to me. I've seen you be homophobic. He's like, and I now know that, you know, you're so far from that. He had a housemate who went to school with us, and she knew that I was coming over. And she was like, why is he even coming over to this house? And then, this was like 10 years down the track from our high school. And then he sent me a message like 3 days later. It's like, you know, she said that you are not the person that she knew. You know, you're a nice guy, all this sort of stuff. And I think it's just people just need to realize but own it. I think once you hide it, that's when things don't change.
Yeah.
And I was starting to pull myself up with things that I was saying or doing, you know.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to have that capacity. So when you started putting the show together and you started weaving these things in, how does the actual then process of making a show work? Like, I mean, because this is fascinating, because you're essentially a kid. Like, in terms of being a, you know, a creator of a show in the way that this is, you know, like the creative force behind it, an original idea, you know, in our industry... You know, they're throwing a lot of that, this, you know, new idea, this thing that a lot of people aren't seeing on Australian TV, in the hands of someone who, you know, doesn't have the hugest amount of experience but has a good story to tell. How is the process? What's that like?
I think for me, it is about being, you know, I think I've got a good, like, this show couldn't have been made if it was just me. Uh-huh. It would be shit, to be honest. Like, I think... You know, the thing that makes this show is it's so collaborative. You know, I've got a great producing partner in Rosemary Blight. We, you know, we can like I said earlier, we can argue, we can have a conversation and be heated, but know that we want to make the same, the best product we can, and we disagree on things that are story points or anything like that. But I think it's the process for me is about working and listening to other people to get it. I think when people jump onto a project, they're jumping on it because they want to help. And I think you learn, you quickly see the people who are there for a paycheck, and they're the ones that you go, well, I know we're not going to work together anymore, or even through this complete project. You know, like, I think there are people there who actually are like, I see where we want, what we want to make. Know the team's got a good energy, and I think that was the biggest thing for this show. Like, our set, everyone was friends. You know, like, it felt good. We got cast and crew who are like ringing us up, going, "Can we come back? When do you start?" You know, and I think for me that was really good. But I think as a producer and with Rose, it was ridiculously hard. But we hid that from everyone else,
right?
To make sure that we made the project that we wanted to.
What was
the
hardest thing about it, do you think? Like, what was the thing that, like, you know, like, was the... Tell me this, maybe. What was the thing that you didn't know before you started this process would be the hardest thing about it that ended up being very hard? The thing that surprised you, I guess.
I guess the hardest thing for me was letting go of ideas.
Wow.
And letting other people own those ideas. And... when you realise that it's okay to do that, that they've got, you know, they've got great ideas themselves, or they're going to push your idea even further. And at first I was just like, no, that sounds shit. I don't want to do that, or I wouldn't do it that way. And I still think you're going to find that all the way through.
Right.
But I think you now handle it in a different way. You know, you even sitting in the edit suites and with the directors, you know. Everyone has their vision or different decisions of what they make, and you watch the cut and then you think in your head, like, well, I wouldn't have done it like that. But let's keep going, you know? Like, right. I think for me it was just learning to open up.
And when you watch the show, like, eventually, when it screens, where do you do that first? Like, do you sit at home on the first night it's on the ABC and watch it live? I mean, I imagine by then you've seen it plenty of times.
Yeah.
But like, in a sense of... Like, you know, when it first goes to air in Australia, your TV show, did you have a party or did you sit around at home and watch it?
I just wanted to sit at home for the first one. There was something good of just sitting at home. I really enjoyed live tweeting at the same time.
Uh-huh.
I think for me, you get to see people's reactions as they're watching it. You never get that, you know. The other thing was there's a pub in Redfern that I'd always would go to, and... I'd often, when I had a shit day on set, I would go to this one pub and I'd drink up. And I realised I saw them tweeting that they were showing the show.
Oh, yeah, okay.
On Thursday night. So I was like, well, fuck, I should go down there and attend one. So I called up Hunter, who plays the lead, and I said, look, this pub shows the thing, we should go down and see if we can get some people. And we got some people to go, and it was just amazing to see everyone's there just drinking, having a good time. And then as soon as it hit 9:30, it was dead quiet, and right. Everyone sat there, and it was fun because, like, you'd hear people yell out smart ass comments when at the characters and join in, and that was just a complete different feeling as well. Like, I think there's something about watching it with your audience or being there with it. Like, I guess, you know, as a filmmaker or TV, you don't get to see the reaction. If you're a musician or you're a comedian, you don't get the act, you know, the audience to
right, the immediate
to you.
Reaction.
Yeah, and I think there was just something special of just being there and listening to people have fun.
All right, we should finish up soon because other people are now out here having dinner and we've probably just spoiled it by them. Like, I noticed that some guys sat down next to us before and then moved away. I did warn you that I'll ask you about this one because I like to ask people. So what do you think happens when we die? I always like to ask people that. Do you have an idea? Do you have a thought? Do you care one way or the other?
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting one for me. Like, the journey going through high school, I was a prick, so I was just like, well, nothing happens, just, you know. And for me, like, learning more about culture and understanding it more, I do feel like there is a different side. I don't know what it is. I don't know. We can never explain it. But I do feel like when you pass, you pass over to family. I do feel like there's a better side. There's different levels of how I got to that, you know, especially through my depression and having friends who also had depression and who have killed themselves. And yeah. I guess one thing that we always would talk about was like, well, now they're better. Now they feel good. And I think that's something really important. And it's something I talk to my son about. It's like, you know, because, I was going to Paris, I was going to Germany, and he always like, he'd think of the terrorist attack.
Right, yeah.
And he's like, you can't go there, Dad. I'm like, look, nothing's going to happen to me. I said, if something has, you're going to see me again someday, just not right now. So I think there is another side.
You've talked about him a lot, like in this, you know, and it comes up very naturally, you know. Obviously, he's very important to you in like the way that you, being a father. Do you have a fathering philosophy? Like, is there something that you like, you know, is it a day by day thing, or do you have like kind of, you know, a firm idea about this is how I want to be a father?
I'm no longer with his mother.
Yeah.
But I've asked to have him. I've said to her when I left, I was like, I don't want to be a weekend dad. So I have him a whole week. She has him a whole week. Okay. So we have week on, week off. And for me, I always just want to be there for him. I always want to. I guess what I have is nothing's off limits. If he asks me a question, doesn't matter what it is, I'll give him the truth.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny, with my girlfriend, she comes over and she's living with us now. But I have a rule with my son. Like, we play a lot of video games together.
Uh-huh.
And I've said to him, you know, it's okay for you to swear if you don't like what's happened on the screen. I said, but you've got to learn when you can swear and when you can't swear. The very first time I said to him, like, I saw him swear, I'm like, all right, first, I'll give you the permission to swear whenever you want when you know how to use it in context. And he asked me what was context.
Right.
And I was like, figure that out and you can swear. And so, you know, it was those sort of things is what, you know, I'll wait for him to ask a question and I'll give him the answer. I remember he asked me about sex when we were out to dinner one night and there was a couple of college uni girls there and I was like, well. Well, laying it out and they're all just like giving me weird looks. I think, yeah, for me it's it is about just being completely honest to him and letting him know what is socially acceptable. I think if I hide things from him, he's not going to grow.
What do you think about Australia and where we're at when it comes to, you know, what his future will be like, you know, as a person who, you know, like if he is a person who wants to, you know, identify and be proud of and like, you know, pursue and know about being an Indigenous person and the history of Indigenous people in our country and all those sort of things. What are your, you know, hopes and thoughts for, you know, where we're at and where we're going?
Look, I think there's...
I know that's two, a big... I know that's a big question.
Yeah, I think there's, I think don't there's expect two ways to go about that. I think the way that I first see it is I prepare him to deal with whatever situation we're in.
Yeah.
And to just be... either have thick skin, know who he is, and not give a fuck what anyone else says.
Yeah.
Know who you are. And if people call you a liar and you're not, then you're fine. Who cares? I guess a part of me feels like this country's gone back.
Yeah.
I feel like a part of me thought, great, we're progressing and my son's not going to have the same issues that I had growing up. But I feel like we've gone back 20 years.
Why? I mean, I know, again, it's not your place to have the answer to that, but do you have a theory or a thought on why you think it might be?
I think we started to become more tolerant to shit.
Yeah.
And not enough people were voicing things they didn't approve. They're like, well, that person has that opinion, fuck it, I'll just keep doing my thing. I remember we had a screening in Berlin, and there was an Inuit man there, and he said to me, he's like, what happened in Australia? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, you black fellas, you used to be the forefront. You used to fight for your civil rights. You used to fight for rights of black people everywhere. And we looked up to the things that you were doing, but you guys don't do that anymore. And I was like, fuck, you're right. Like, I think everyone in general, on any of their sort of platforms, have just become okay with their way of life. And I think it's not until push comes to shove where people are going to start to come stand up. And I think we're at that circle again where people are going to start up standing up again and voicing and forcing the movement.
Mate, this has been an absolute pleasure, but we should finish up because now officially there are people next to us, so we probably should. We've eventually got to the point where I think, yeah, it's time for us to finish the podcast. But tell people where they can see Clever Man. Now, people listen to this all over the world, so where can they see it at the moment? What countries can they see it? But
we've wrapped up in Australia, but we're still on iView for, I think, another week.
ABC iView. Okay, so another week. I'll put this up to make sure that the people hear about that then.
Okay, great.
And does it then go to, like, DVD or iTunes
DVD and Blu-ray release in August.
Okay.
And then we have, for the people in the UK, we're on ABC, BBC Three in a few months. And then we'll be back in the States again.
So that's absolutely brilliant. I highly recommend checking out this show. It's fantastic. I first messaged you because I was having of all the times to hook up a podcast. This is an insight into how I organise this podcast. I was at a music festival in Barcelona having a conversation with a stranger on a hill, and I went to check. And I'm going to send you a message. So, this is where that all started. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate, and thank you so much.
It's been awesome. Thank you.
I gotta know where you stay for.